First thing we ask you is, what was your name at birth?
Isaac Goldberger.
Okay.
Spelt with a Z and an AK.
Oh, okay. And when was that?
1934.
Were.
In Hamburg.
In Hamburg, Germany. Okay. So 1934. So can you tell us anything about your early life? What did your parents do?
I don't really know. My mother was a seamstress who made all the clothes for all the family. I was the baby. And she also made suits for my father. But he did various jobs. He had a patisserie and bakery on Kristallnacht and it got smashed up. And then after that, he did various jobs. He was forced into various jobs. One of them was to be the kosher cook, kosher supervisor on board a transatlantic ship.
So the patisserie is, did you get lots of lovely cakes at home?
I have no recollection at all because Kristallnacht was about when I was born.
Right. Okay. So and then he went off and did all different types of jobs.
Oh yeah, one of them was labouring and apparently he couldn't handle that. But I only heard most of this by hearsay.
And who was in your family?
My four brothers and sisters. The oldest one was Deborah, then Abraham, then Esther, then Marcus, and then long afterwards me. I was 7 years younger than Marcus.
So, do you remember anything about your life? Did you ever meet other Jewish families? Or
I certainly don't remember anything like that. I know we lived on a Argathenstrasse, number 3 Argathenstrasse, and I know we had a balcony, and we used to go out when an aeroplane went overhead. We'd all go out quite excited to see it. But the only thing I can remember there is I had diphtheria, and so did Deborah. So we were isolated from the others. And when we were recovering from diphtheria, I remember causing a bit of a hassle by melting some chocolate drops on top of the little stove. I can remember that caused a bit of a hassle. But I can remember very little else.
Were you taken to synagogue?
Well, I must have been. My father was a ultra-Orthodox Jew, so I must have been regular at the synagogue, I would have thought. I don't remember it at all. I suppose I can remember them unrolling the two rolls.
Torah.
Yeah, I didn't know what it was. But
yeah.
I can remember that very vaguely.
And did you see your grandparents a lot? Or?
I saw grandparents a little, and one of the grandfathers, I don't know, I only remember grandparents, I don't have any memory of which was which. My grandmother, one of my grandmothers, was bedridden, and one of my grandfathers was, quote, a noted scribe. But beyond that, I have no recollection.
So he was a scribe for,
I assume, the Jewish religion.
Right, writing in the Torah. So what happened when Kristallnacht happened?
Yeah.
Life changed.
Yeah.
Can you remember any of that?
Not really. I was kept sort of ticking over.
Yeah.
So I don't really remember. I'm trying to think if I remember anything else from that time at all.
How about Esther, your eldest? Or Deborah is your eldest one?
Deborah is the oldest of the lot.
Yeah.
And she and I had the
diphtheria
together. I can't really recall much else.
Okay.
I was told, again hearsay, that my father's favourite was Esther, the younger daughter. He was clearly the favourite. She was clearly the favourite.
So, what happened after things got very tough for your parents, obviously, and then what happened?
Well, I remember that my father went into hiding, and it was a cellar with a window at street level, so I'm told. I don't recall it. And then the five of us went with my mother in a taxi. And I believe I was crying, but I had no idea what it was about. And we were taken to a train station and got on the train and said goodbye to my mother. I don't recall that. But then my next memory is that we were in Belgium and the kind ladies there gave us all sticky buns. And then we went on to the Kinder transport, and again, I have no recollection of the transport itself at all. But I remember when we got off, we went through the customs, and I had a little khaki canvas rucksack on. Don't forget, I was 2 days before my 5th birthday, and some nasty customs man put a big chalk cross on the back of my rucksack, and I was mortally offended. I can remember that, how offended I was.
Do you know what was in it?
No idea.
Can't remember.
No. And eventually we, Esther and I, went to the house of the Khan family in Finsbury Park, and the Khan family were also ultra-Orthodox Jews, so apparently I was asked, Esther has told me that I was asked lots of Hebrew-type questions before I was even allowed in the door. But 3 weeks after that, all the London kids were evacuated, and I ended up with a crowd of other kids in St Ives in what is now Cambridgeshire. And the billeting officer was Miss Kitty Wiles, who'd worked in the local office of the town clerk's office. So she was the billeting officer, and she put Esther and I in the Lamb public house. And my one memory of the Lamb is that Esther and I couldn't speak any English, and we went down into the bar, and all the men, and it was only men, were apparently joshing and joking with us. They were all quite kindly. And then Kitty Wiles thought that was unsuitable. So she moved us to the house of a Mrs. Middleton, Mr. and Mrs. Middleton. And I haven't the faintest recollection of Mr. Middleton. I think he was a total non-entity. She ruled the roost of everything. Mm-hmm. And she had two teenage daughters and hated the idea of having these two nasty little Jewish kids lumbered on her. And the house, despite the fact she was a big snob, the house overlooked St Ives Slaughterhouse. Again, that didn't last long. And then we were transferred by Kitty Wiles to a Mrs. Saby. Mrs. Saby was a kindly widow living in a little terraced hot cottage in, I think it was called Park Lane, but it was a little drive up to the park in St Ives. Mm-hmm. And I was there for the first Christmas. I have very little memory of that, but I was there for the first Christmas, and she invited her widowed sister and her lodger, who lived in one of the other little cottages, in for Christmas. And I remember he would give Esther a ride on his back, the lodger, and I used to caterwaul, and then he'd give me a ride on his back, and I still used to caterwaul, so I was obviously a miserable little beggar at the time. And my sister got friendly with a girl at school who invited her to a party at May Wiles, the sister of the billeting officer. And she said she couldn't go unless I went with her. So I got towed along with her and immediately made friends with two evacuated kids, Ronnie and Shirley Kitto.
Right. Were they kinder transport as well?
No, they weren't kinder transport. They were evacuees from London.
Right.
And I don't think the girl Esther had made friends with was kinder transport. Mm-hmm. And the upshot of it was I and Esther went to live with May Wiles, and that was a big house owned by the Baptist Chapel, and the widowed... Her mother, the widow of the Baptist pastor, and that was a strict Baptist chapel, he had died just before the war, and so the widow was there, and her younger daughter, May, was looking after her, and she ended up with 13 evacuated children.
Wow.
Her cousin, just down the road, ended up with 21 evacuated children.
Must have been a big house.
Yeah, it was, but the cousin with the 21 evacuated children was pictured on the full back page photo of the Sunday Pictorial because of the 13 evacuated children. Uh-huh. But that was May Wiles was the sister of the billeting officer, Kitty Wiles. Uh-huh. And of course we were all marched to the strict Baptist chapel every Sunday, and later on every Wednesday as well, or most of Wednesdays. But May started off by feeding Esther and I only things she thought would not offend the Jewish faith, and then realised, she told me later, it was wartime and we just have to eat what we could get. So I'm afraid she started feeding us whatever the others had, including roast pork, which I suppose I should feel sorry to say, instantly became my favourite roast.
Were always things that you're not supposed to have.
Yeah, I think it was the crackling that attracted me. But I do remember that became my favourite very quickly. And we were well looked after. And at the end of the war...
Where did you go to school?
In what was called the St Ives Council School. But there was two council schools. One was the local council school and the other was the evacuated council school, mm-hmm. and we were upstairs in the Free Church Hall. And again, I have very little memory of that, except they used to cane you across the hands if you spoke in class. Everybody who spoke in class got two or three cuts across their hands, and the cane was often not in the room you were in. So one boy who'd been caned rather a lot was sent to fetch the cane from another room when the master was going to cane him. And when he brought it into the room, he put it across his knee. First he lashed out at the master's legs. And then when he'd had a good cut of the master's legs, he put it across his knee and threw it out of the window.
Wow.
I can't remember what happened to him, but I can remember that incident very well.
Uh-huh. So were there other children in this, other Jewish children in this school?
I have no recollection at all.
So, but you just all got on, all the evacuees?
All got on with each other, yeah.
Uh-huh. And what was the education like? Was it?
I don't remember it being particularly good, but May Wiles obviously got to like me a lot, and to like Esther. She sent Esther for 4 years to two different private schools, for which she had to pay, and she wanted me to get the scholarship to go to the grammar school.
Mm-hmm.
So she got a whole load of past papers from the school. And at 10 years old, she was drumming me through these papers every night, once or twice even reducing me to tears over the papers. But of course, I didn't realise, she didn't obviously, scholarship papers were essentially intelligence tests. And if you practice with intelligence tests, you get better at it, even if you're not more intelligent.
So you were telling me earlier about life during the war, how May gave you a job.
With the pigs. And the three pigs that we had in the sty across the allotments, and that's where she met Ted Gibson, who used to come across from the allotment and see her, and he was the one who knew me. And
from the pub?
The people who came in at Christmas.
Right.
The little widow lady who came in at Christmas,
uh-huh.
He was her lodger. And he got to know May, because I introduced them. And a year or two later, they married.
Oh, what a story.
Well, I think it's quite a story, but quite amazing.
Isn't that lovely?
And both of them had never married before.
Uh-huh.
And he was a farm labourer. And, uh-huh. You know, for a daughter of a strict Baptist pastor to marry a farm labourer, uh-huh. was a bit down the market.
Uh-huh.
But they moved out to Hyams Farm in St Ives, which was an Animal Health Trust farm. And after a few years, and I operated from there to my final years at school,
mm-hmm.
He eventually got moved by the Animal Health Trust because he'd had experience with horses when he'd been in a military horse brigade in India. And he got moved out to Newmarket, where they had Ballaton Lodge, which was a great big lodge house, half of which was now laboratories, and the other half was stables. And he was the man put in charge of the stables. And I lived there with them for a while. And of course, I didn't tell you the last bit of the pig story. Well, imagine a good Jewish boy looking after the pigs.
Apparently, if you're Jewish, you can keep pigs as long as you don't eat it.
Is that right? Yeah, I didn't know that.
Apparently. I don't know if it's true.
Anyway, I got the sale price of one of them, and I bought a beautiful drop-handlebar bike called a Philips Vox Populi. And I had that for many, many years and treasured it. And I sailed through the scholarship. So I went to the grammar school, and I was one of 7% of the kids that got there without any further testing, and another 10% got there with further testing. So, of course, they expected great things of me, and there wasn't anything great there. I came bottom of the class, or close to the bottom, three terms running. So they transferred me from the A form to the B form, and after I'd still come close to the bottom, they thought, well, we better G this fella up a bit. So they put me back into the A form in the hope that it would G me up a bit. It didn't. I was still close to the bottom, three terms running. And then they put me into, they had a lower and an upper five. They put me into the lower 5B, and my brain must have gone into action at last. And I came top of the class three terms running and got the form prize, which I still think is rather spectacular. And then I was forced into taking eight subjects in school certificate, and it was the last year of the school certificate. And one subject I'd taken all the way through, which was French, and nobody had ever told me what the hell the point was in learning a foreign language. They tried me in the school in learning German for 1 year, Latin for 1 year, and French for 6 years. And I failed the French, and I also failed technical drawing. I was useless at the French. I'd never paid any attention at all. Mm-hmm. But I did get six subjects, which was the school certificate. But I didn't get a foreign language. And of the A and B forms, only six kids got a credit in maths, and I was one of them, which was surprising because I was in the B form at that stage. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to leave. I was 16 and wanted to leave.
Had the war finished by this time?
It must have done, yeah. I can remember the huge celebrations in the main street in St Ives, but beyond that, nothing really. Mm-hmm. And then May absolutely wanted me to go on to the sixth form. And I absolutely wanted to leave and earn some money.
So what happened to the evacuees from London?
They all went back.
Uh-huh. Was it a sad day when they went back?
I can't recall that, but they all went back. And May then got a girl from a nursery, who she thought was an orphan. I think she was an orphan, from a nursery, who was 4 years younger than me. And she grew up more or less as my sister. Mm. Her name was Barbara Wells. We found out later she was the great niece of H.G. Wells, the author.
Really?
Apparently so. But she, May insisted I stay into the sixth form. And so despite the fact that I'm a renowned chatterbox, I didn't speak to her for a whole term. I was so cross, but she made me go on to the sixth form, uh-huh. And it was in the grammar school, and it was the first time I'd actually enjoyed school at all. The only problem was they made me take three subjects, and they'd timetabled it so that you couldn't take maths and biology and chemistry. If you wanted to take biology and chemistry, you couldn't take maths, you had to take physics. And frankly, advanced level physics without advanced level maths, you're talking Chinese. Mm-hmm. It just didn't make any sense at all. And after four terms copying my friend's homework, I got the headmaster to allow me to drop it. So I only took two subjects at A level and only passed one. I passed biology and failed the chemistry.
But did you feel different because you'd left Germany and...
Not at all. I mean, I I'd been in May Wilde's house for quite a number of years then, gone to the local chapel, gone to the Scouts. I was just a normal lad.
And how was Esther?
She stayed with May Wilde's after 4 years of private schools, and then she decided she would go into nursing and chose not to go to the local nursing school. She went to a nursing school in Nuneaton, whereas I stayed on. I carried on with the Scouts and eventually became a senior scout. And I had a little group of about 8 or 9 of us who were senior scouts. And the senior scoutmaster was a naval man, so the senior scouts all became sea scouts.
And what year was this?
I can't recall, but I was 15 when I went into the senior scouts,
right.
So we could work it out, but
49,
yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. And the he got us all in to become sea scouts, and then he encouraged us to collect badges, the scout badges, and eventually I and 2 or 3 others got enough badges to be awarded the King Scout Award, and then the King died. So we became the UK's first Queen Scouts. And there was one interesting little thing which until recently I had totally forgotten. The Queen and the whole court went into mourning, black clothes, and she performed one royal function before the coronation, because she thought her father would have wanted her to, which was to take the salute of the new, as they were then, Queen Scouts. And I remember camping on Eton College playing fields, giving a pep talk by the chief scout, who was Lord Allen, and we made our fires and had our dinner on Eton College playing fields. And then the next morning we got into a sort of column and marched past the Queen and her royal party, who were in the grounds of Windsor Castle, and we marched into St George's Chapel to a service of thanksgiving and commemoration. And I'd totally forgotten that until the Queen's celebrations. And even my daughter hadn't heard that story.
Yeah. So did you see yourself on TV?
I don't recall that,
no.
But my daughter, very good with the internet, she immediately sent to the Boy Scouts Association and asked them for any pictures they had of the event.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got 4 pictures on the computer now, and one of them is the front of the parade going past the Queen. And I'm pretty sure one of the people you can see is me. And my daughter thinks it's me as well.
Mm-hmm.
We're not quite sure.
Uh-huh.
But we think it's me. When I wanted to go into an agricultural college, because I'd moved house and because I hadn't got a foreign language at O-level, at school certificate level, that means I couldn't go for a degree course, goodness knows why. So they put me down to a diploma course at what was really the second best school of agriculture or dairying in the country, Sutton Bonington School of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And we then moved to Suffolk, to Ballaton Lodge, and I applied for a grant. And of course, grants for diploma courses weren't obligatory anyway, and as I'd just moved county, they weren't interested.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to give up the idea of agricultural college. And then I did something very, very strange. I thought, well, all my school friends are going off to national service. And because I'm not, quote, British, I'm not being called up. And if I'd stayed not British until I was 26, I wouldn't have been called up. But at 19, I went along and got naturalised so that I was British, and changed my name to Gibson, which was the married man
who'd
married May Wilde.
Right.
So I changed my name to their name, Gibson, and I walked into the Labour Exchange. I can remember that clearly. They didn't call me up. So I walked into the Labour Exchange in Newmarket and said, look, I'm a British citizen, you should call me up. So I must have been National Service's only volunteer. And I went into the National Service and I wanted to be a pilot on the principle that then I could be a pilot in Civvy Street. So they sent me and 14 other youngsters to Hornchurch, where we 4 days of a selection for pilot.
They gave you a choice. They actually allowed you to do that.
I can't remember why they allowed me to go to Hornchurch. But I went to Hornchurch and we had 4 days of selection. And at the end of it, they lined the 15 of us up and said, well, you two have been awarded pilot national service. You two have been awarded air signaller if you sign on for 8 years without a commission. And the rest of you have been offered nothing. And I was offered the air signaller. And I thought, without the commission, air signaller, no civilian job like it, no thanks. So they sent me back to the square bashing camp. And there they put me in the kitchen for 3 weeks, which meant I ate better than anybody else on the camp because you picked the food before it went out. And then they sent me to Middle Wallop to train as a fighter plotter. And 3/4 of the way through the training, they said, where would you like to be posted? And I thought, oh, this is good. So I said, East Anglia, or alternatively, the Far East, because I'll never be able to afford to go there on my own. So they posted me to North Yorkshire.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds better. That sounds like the National Service.
Absolutely. They posted me to North Yorkshire, and it was to a little unit called RAF Shipton, which was inside RAF Linton-on-Ouse. It was a separate unit, but we lived on the camp at RAF Linton-on-Ouse.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, RAF Shipton was supposed to be deadly secret. And it was a huge underground complex, which you went to by coach 6 miles from RAF Shipton.
Where was that? Was it near York?
It was near York, uh-huh. About 6 or 7 miles from York. And we went to this huge underground complex, and the amazing thing was anybody watching the coaches coming out of RAF Linton-on-Ouse could have seen 60 young men get out of the coaches and all walk into a building the size of an ordinary house. We would frankly have had to stand on each other's shoulders. But even when they got to know you, you had to wave your security pass because it was secret for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then you went down some steps and into a long 12-foot wide, or thereabouts, corridor, which sloped downwards until you got to the operations centre, which was 3 stories, all underground, horseshoe shape, with all the horseshoe with officers who did the aircraft controlling. And in the middle of the horseshoe was this massive picture of the British Isles where you did the plotting, to show where the planes were.
Mm-hmm.
And then the screen in front had the weather, which planes were flying, and all such information. And then amongst the officers' rooms, there was also a direction-finding unit, which you went to sometimes, where a plane would call out, fix, 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 and he'd be in direct line to one of the 10 people or so sitting around this table, and there'd be 4 or 5 people would get this call, fix, 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 and you would actually pull out a string which showed the direction the plane was in, and where the string crossed showed you where the plane was.
Right.
And that was passed to the officers, and they would then tell the plane where he was.
Mm-hmm. Did you enjoy National Service?
Some of it. But the thing about it is, Shipton, we worked morning one day and afternoon the next. And if you were working in the mornings and the planes flew in the evenings, which wasn't that often, then the morning shift would get called on again to man the operations centre.
Mm-hmm.
So we had an enormous amount of spare time. And, I mean, I'd been taught, more or less from the Baptist folks, that playing cards were, you know, part of the devil.
Mm-hmm.
In that camp, we played 3-card blind brag for pennies, we'd not got much money, 5 nights a week because we were so bored. And then on Saturday nights, I'd fetched my lovely bike up from Newmarket And I'd had it, what, 7 or 8 years by then, maybe even more, whatever. I haven't calculated how long I had it, but I brought it up on the train, and then on Saturday night, the last bus from York to the camp was about 10 o'clock, which was pretty useless to a 19-year-old. So I used to cycle the 10 miles into York, go to a dance at the De Grey Rooms, and then cycle back around midnight. That was okay. That was I enjoyed that bit.
How long was national service?
2 years.
And when you got out and you were all in your civvies and you were just about to leave the camp, you always had to go and sit in front of the group captain, who was the camp commander. It was a long table. I suspect it was the officer's mess table. It was a very long table. And he would sit at one end and you would sit at the other end. And he'd always ask the same question: what did you think of your national service? He asked me the usual question. And I said, the first few months when we were training, that was all right. The rest of it was a complete waste of time. And instead of being offended, the group captain got up from his end of the table, walked the length of the table, shook my hand vigorously, and agreed with me completely. So I was very pleased I'd actually come out with the right thing.
Right.
Then I came out and for a little while had no job.
And how old were you at this time?
I must have been 20, 21.
Yeah.
And then I finally got a job in Ware at a firm called Allen & Hanbury's, the oldest pharmaceutical firm in the country. And I got a job in the chemical research laboratory as a lab assistant. The firm eventually, while I was there, got swallowed up by Glaxo. Mm-hmm. But I worked under a guy called Jan Gladich, a Polish guy. And he was the most gentle, tolerant guy you could meet. And in 7 years working for him, we only ever had cross words about once. But he was the most tolerant guy of every nationality in the world.
Were you still conscious you were German and you were a kinder?
Just about.
Did you ever mention it to people?
Oh, yeah. Jan Gladich knew. He knew all about my background.
Yeah. And how about in school?
Well, they knew. I mean, don't forget, I didn't get naturalised until after school.
Right. How did he find learning English?
I don't know, but I suspect, like a small child, if you're amongst people all speaking English, you absorb it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't consciously remember learning English, but in the end, the only language I wanted to know anything about was English. Mm-hmm. And nobody could persuade me there was any point in learning a foreign language, which is why, after 6 years of taking French, I failed it miserably. Jan was a lovely guy. He really was a nice guy. Again, like the fellows here, everybody liked him. He just was a nice guy.
Mm-hmm. So did he encourage you to have more education?
Oh, yes. And Allen & Hanbury's did too. They sent me off to Hatfield Technical College to do the A-levels again, because I'd only got one. And this time, doing one day a week instead of 5 days a week, I passed chemistry, biology and maths in the first year I took them, very easily. And then the college, I slogged my guts out. Up until Christmas, I often spent the evening studying. After Christmas, and of course I was married then, after Christmas I used to send my wife out with friends, because I would not go out after Christmas at all. And I studied every evening. And 2 weeks or 3 weeks before the exam, I took 2 weeks off work without pay and spent every day doing about 12 hours studying a day. And then we did the finals. And I went up with a very good friend of mine to look at the board. They put the finals results up, just your exam number, outside Senate House. And we went up there, and if you'd asked me, I would have started looking at the bottom. And I was told before I went, for God's sake, don't do that. If you go through all the past degrees and you're not there, and then the lower seconds, and you're not there, you will start thinking you've failed. So you go from the top, and I got a little way down, and I got a 2-1.
Wow. So you obviously enjoyed the scientific side of
education.
Oh,
yeah. I was altogether as, you know, going towards science.
Mm-hmm.
And with the pass degree, with the 2-1, I immediately got an offer from the college that they'd got their first ever Science Research Council grant to do a PhD, and they offered it to me. And I was 29. I really didn't know whether to take it or not. I'd been married for several years. I hadn't, what am I talking about? I really didn't know whether I should take this offer. And I went to see Allen and Hanbury's research director. I can only remember he was David somebody. Nice guy. So he led me, grabbed the letter, led me into his office, and I can still remember him throwing himself back in his chair, putting his feet on his table to read the letter. And then he looked at me and he said, "If you don't take this, you must have a hole in your head." So I took it. Israel and Greece and Sicily and a couple of other places to travel there. And he announced it just like that. And the academic board said, "What's Stellaria media?" And he had to say chickweed, at which point the entire academic board fell about laughing, and I didn't get my grant.
Oh.
So I then sent to the universities in all these countries, and the guy at Kew Gardens advised me, and I sent just to Israel, Greece and Sicily, and Israel and Greece turned me down. But Italy, who was a very poor country, offered me a 1 month grant, a 2 month grant, or a 6 month grant. And I said, "Look, I'm only going for 2 weeks." And they said, "Oh, well, you'll have to have a 1 month grant." So I accepted I'd have a 1 month grant, and off I went. When I got to Italy, I hadn't got the grant money. I had to go, I went to Sicily, and I was told, "Go to the university and they'll have your money." And I found the university in Palermo, and there was this lovely old guy as the prof who couldn't speak English, with a very sharply dressed young man, who, when I said I'd come to collect the grant money, he said, "No money, no money," etc. And just then, an Italian priest came round the corner in the building, and he said, "Ah, the grant money." And he went and fetched the grant voucher. And I'm still convinced that the sharply dressed young man was the mafia. And he was trying to keep the money. It was very difficult to think otherwise.
Right.
So you can imagine what happened when I went to the bank to cash this voucher. I was looking nervously over each shoulder in case the mafia were around. They weren't.
So did you specialise in plants?
Well, I applied for the assistant lectureship. I got the job as assistant lecturer, and 2 years later became a lecturer, and 2 years after that, a senior lecturer. But I was by that time specialised in bacterial and viral genetics, and since I was in the group of people, the microbiology group, and there were quite a number of microbiologists in there, my chance of getting any further than a senior lecturer was zero.
Mm-hmm.
They announced that Hatfield was going to be one of the new universities. So it was going to be a polytechnic. And we were a polytechnic for about 30-odd years, and then they decided to abolish the polytechnics and make all the polytechnics university. And just 2 months before I retired, Hatfield became the University of Hertfordshire.
Mm-hmm.
And they leaned on everybody over the age of 55 to retire early. All my colleagues in the department said, "Take the money and run." So I took the money and retired at 57. And had always decided to move to Ullapool.
Right. So you already had your family.
I had two children.
Uh-huh.
And I always joke with people, they had the average intelligence between them, unfortunately not evenly shared out. So my son had Down syndrome, and my daughter is brilliant. She's far more than average. So you know the normal distribution for intelligence, that children are expected to be somewhere in the middle of the bow in the normal. And 2.5% will be brighter than their parents, and 2.5% will be duller. I've got one of each end. Kate, I knew Kate was brighter than me by the time she was 12. I didn't mind. To me, it seemed I should be very pleased that I've got a very bright kid. And I had. She's now a consultant in clinical genetics, working in Queensland. And to me, that's a pretty fierce job. She knows what she's doing. And I joke that years ago she did as I said, and we've reached the stage now where I do as she says.
That's old age for you. So, and your son, where is he?
He has Down syndrome, and we had, he was a very bright Downs, and apart from the first 10 years when he had lots of physical and physical illness problems, he had an imperforate anus for a start, so they had to operate. He then got a blockage and they had to operate again, and he got thyroid deficiency. But once they got it all sorted, frankly, he and I particularly, but his mum as well a bit, but he and I particularly had a ball. We had such fun together, because he learnt to play snooker, and when I played snooker or pool with him, I never once made it easy for him. I always played as well as I could, which isn't brilliant, and that made, he fought to beat me. And I did the same with swimming, and for years he couldn't beat me, and I would slow down so that I only beat him by a little. And in the end he could beat me, no question about it at all. And he won 70 or so swimming medals, going into swimming competitions with other disabled kids, where they have lots of competitions. They have staggered starts. And they know the time that the kids have swum their distance before. And if they gain in a race by more than 3 seconds a length, then they disqualify them. Well, Ian never did that, but he took all the medals going.
Brilliant.
And he one year won the national trophy. They put the top kids from each area into the national competition, and we went and saw him win the national trophy. He was a superb swimmer. In Ullapool Pool, he would go in there with me 3 times a week, and like me, he would swim 30 lengths. I mean, how many Downs kids do that?
How many people have Downs kids can do that?
But I mean, the Downs people normally can't concentrate to that extent.
Right.
But he certainly could. And unfortunately, now he's got dementia as well. And he's in Fairburn House.
Near here?
Near to Inverness, about 12 miles from Inverness. When we had the car, we used to go once a month and take him out to lunch. Now we go when we can, when with friends are here and so on.
So you were retired, and then the decision to come to Ullapool.
That was made easy because we came here on our holidays towing an old caravan for, I never remember whether it's 17 or 18 years. We fell in love with Ullapool and said we'd retire here. And the last year we came, before we moved up here, our friends also in the caravan said, why don't you, it was a rotten weather, why don't you go and look at the houses for sale? And this was one of them. And the couple that ran this one also ran it as a bed and breakfast. And they said, well, they'd only put it on the market 1 week. And they were trying to find somewhere for themselves. So we said, well, keep us in mind if we're still looking, and we could be interested. And I suppose what happened then was we decided we'd travel for 6 months. So we travelled for 6 months to Australia and New Zealand and had a wonderful time. And then we came back and started seriously looking for a house. And this one was still for sale. And the price we paid, all the locals said, ooh, too expensive. But when you actually think what it would sell at now, it's frightening.
Mm-hmm. Where was Anne from? Was she from...
Not St Ives. Where are we in...
In Huntingdon? So you came to Ullapool and you're running a bed and breakfast.
Yeah.
Was it easy to start a business in Scotland?
It was pretty easy to start a bed and breakfast.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. You just put up your sign.
Oh, yeah.
If you've got less than three rooms, up to three rooms, you don't have to sort of register it as a business or anything. So we had two rooms we let out because Ian had the downstairs room. And we had one of the upstairs rooms. We let out two rooms. And we always made sure our price was in the middle of the price range. Not at the top or the bottom, but in the middle. And then we decided we'd do the best breakfast in the village. So I used to bake all the bread. Every breakfast they had a freshly baked roll, sometimes out of the freezer. But it was a roll that we'd baked with every breakfast. We got the best bacon and eggs and things we could find. In the end, I was making the black pudding and the sausages as well.
Wow.
I just like making things. And both the black pudding and the sausages, rather better than you could buy. I mean, I was serious about that. Mm-hmm. We put slightly more spice in the black pudding, and the sausages, we had it coarse ground by Booker's in Inverness. And we bought the skins and we loaded the coarsely ground sausages with a bit of savoury stuff and pepper and salt with these. And they were very good.
So you got lots of people coming back?
Quite a few came back, but we're so far out that... Well, I mean, we had one couple, a German couple, I think it was, who came 5 years in succession. But we had quite a few people that have come a couple of years. But often people don't come this far north more than once. They're quite frequent, and we would allow them. I mean, some bed and breakfasts say minimum of two nights. We never did that. If they wanted to come for one night, they came for one night. And we enjoyed it. We reckoned that all the jam and marmalade was homemade as well, so they really had. And we didn't put these little silly packet jams out. We used to put a dish of jam and a dish of marmalade. And if they went right down the dish, we'd just fill it up again. We did the breakfast very well. It was a superb breakfast, and everybody who came here said that too.
And the community of Ullapool, what's that like?
Well, we reckon that they're the nicest and friendliest people you could meet anywhere. Where Anne is in Lockbroom House, the care home. I was in there for 6 or 7 weeks because with my first stroke, I've got minor epilepsy, and they gave me some drugs which weren't controlling it entirely. So they gave me another drug, and between the two, they knocked me out. And the result was Anne was here, and I was largely looking after her. And one day I went to put something in the freezer, which is in the garage, and I walked down the steps outside, and you probably discovered there are two steps, and they're quite large steps now. Instead of walking down two steps, I walked down three, which meant I went flat on my face, and I couldn't get up. So Anne pressed her help button. My neighbour came along, who's a good friend. In fact, the man you're staying with, Mike, he came along, and because I'm a bit of a lump, he couldn't lift me, but he called somebody in off the street, and I remember them dragging me into the house. I don't remember anything else till I woke up in Lockbroom House. And of course, because Anne couldn't really look after herself, she got there too. And in Lockbroom House, they have lots of staff coming in on shifts, and without exception, they're fantastic people, without exception. They are kind, friendly, and have the patience of saints. I wouldn't have half the patience they've got. There was one man down there who's got slight dementia, and one night he got incredibly aggressive with the staff. And frankly, if that had been me, I would have said, well, stay where you damn well are until you decide to cooperate. But they didn't. They just had the patience to keep working with him and ignored all the aggression. I would have found that very difficult.
So did you do things with the community? How did you learn to be in the to be accepted by the community?
Well, I mean,
be in it?
Almost at once, I was on the committee of, what was it, the swimming pool? I was on one of the committees for 8 years. They tried to get me on the first year I was here, and I wouldn't accept that. But the second year, I'm trying to remember, it was that, this shows you my memory, I was on one of the local committees, I think it was the swimming pool, but I was on one of the committees for 8 years and met quite a few people that way. And just being round town. When we used to come here on holiday, every time we came up and went into one of the shops, we would get greeted with, nice to see you back. Now, where else would you find that? I mean, it was just a lovely atmosphere. And there are two or three people that we probably wouldn't get on with brilliantly, but on the whole, they are really nice people.
Well, that's nice.
The pace of life is much more sensible here than it was down in Hertfordshire. And, you know, we've been back a few times because our friends, Dennis and Brenda, live in North London. And when we've been back, we just, the hustle and bustle, just terrifying. I like it here much better.
So do you think of yourself as English in Scotland or German English in
Well,
Scotland.
I've never thought of myself as German, weirdly enough, despite having been born there. I think I've always thought of myself as English in Scotland. But as you can see, I'm not really English.
And Kate grew up in England.
Yes.
So she's English.
Oh, totally.
Yes.
And the interesting thing is, my parents, although they were in Germany when I was born, they're both Polish.
Right.
Both my parents were Polish by origin. But you know, Poland wasn't very nice to Jews.
No.
And so they both got out of there and they met in Germany and married in Germany.
We always finish up with sort of reflections on life. You know, and we were talking about the Kinder Transport yesterday. So what was your reflection on life, of the life you've had?
I think I've been extraordinarily lucky. I've had a good home. May Wiles, who married and became Mrs. Gibson, her husband, when they were over 80, they went, I mean, Esther, who only stayed with her for 4 years, Esther had her, had them out to Australia to her eldest daughter's wedding, the two of them. And they loved that. But, no, Esther was in Australia fairly soon after nursing training, whereas I've always been in England. And my reflection on my life is that I've been extraordinarily lucky. May Gibson, May Wiles, May Gibson, gave me a good, stable home. And later on, I had power of attorney, and we always used to go and see her until she got so that she wouldn't have recognised us. She was in a nursing home, and she finally died at 103. But, you know, I did have a good, stable home, and I actually believe that's probably the main thing. I think people think it's the true parents that are the most important. I actually think the people who bring you up are the most important.
What happened to your parents?
We know they got as far as Belgium and were in hiding. And there was a young daughter in the house, and my elder sister, when she was in the WAFS, she went to the house where they were in hiding, and she got a very distinct impression that the daughter had given them away. And she was spitting tacks at the daughter, whereas I had slightly kinder views. I thought this girl at the age of 12 had had people staying with her parents that would have endangered all their lives, and she tolerated it. If she did give them away, we don't know that, but if she did, my reaction is she had survived 3 years of, must have been intense pressure, and she finally cracked. And as a 15-year-old, I can't have a lot of blame for her. Obviously, if she did, we don't know that she gave them away, but if she gave them away, how can you blame her? The strain she must have lived under for 4 years or 3 years.
What happened then?
Well, I've got a document that says they were on the transport to Auschwitz.
Which we have. So they were sent to Auschwitz?
They were sent there but never arrived. That's it. That's the document.